In this episode of Startups for Recipes, I'm going to be talking to Justin Jackson about launching 100 projects in a year. This is Startups for Recipes, episode 296. Welcome to Startups for Recipes, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products. Whether you built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Justin.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How are you doing this week, Justin?
Well, like I was saying, the kids just got out of school, which just feels hectic. It's amazing how much we rely on the kids being occupied all day. And so now it's like, okay, they're out. Now what am I going to do?
Yes, that's actually a really good way to put it. And I'd never quite phrased it verbally before, but it's nice that the kids have school to preoccupy them for 6 or 7 hours on most days of the week.
Now, there is a theory, I don't know if this is real, but there's a theory that schooling, public schooling, really came about because of the Industrial Revolution, because you couldn't have parents working all day and then have kids just running around. And so I don't know if this is true or not, but that's what I've heard, is that a lot of public education came out of, you know, just needing to occupy the kids while mom and dad are in the factory for 12 hours a day.
I would actually guess that it's probably a direct result, not necessarily of the Industrial Revolution, but of child labor laws that prohibit the kids from working.
Oh, yeah. See, now we're getting down. Oh, yeah.
Yep. So that's probably it. But anyway, great to have you on the show. For anyone who's not familiar with Justin, Justin lives in Vernon, BC, which is in British Columbia. To me, I call it Canada on occasion just because I live so close to the border. I used to live in Buffalo, New York. And I mean, literally, you could hit a golf ball and hit Canada.
Well, there you go. Do you have some Tim Hortons there?
Yes, we did have Tim Hortons, so went there on occasion, but, you know.
So you're basically like 30% Canadian.
I guess. I don't know if I'd admit to that publicly on a podcast with thousands of listeners, but I did want to have you on the show because, you know, you just talk a little bit briefly about your history, and you've been the former product manager at Sprintly, and in 2015, you kind of struck out on your own to make your own stuff. You've been kind of around the block, I'll say. You've got three different podcasts that you've run, Product People, Build and Launch, and now you've got Mega Maker that you're working on, and then you've also got a bunch of ebooks that you've written. There's Amplification, the Hacker News Handbook, the Product Hunt Handbook, Marketing for Developers. I'm sure that there's several other ebooks and other podcasts that I'm probably missing in that list. So why don't you, I guess, fill people a little bit more in on some of the highlights for, you know, anything that I might have missed.
Yeah. So I got started in the software business in 2008, working for an email service provider in Edmonton. And I kind of started like ground level, just answering customer emails and doing customer support and kept poking my nose in everything. I was interested in design and development and marketing. And eventually I worked my way up to being product manager in that company. It's actually a good definition of a product manager. They're people that kind of sit in the middle of all those kind of other categories. And then after that, I went to work for a startup called Sprintly in Portland and did that for about 14 months or something like that. And then Sprintly got sold. And I had this decision to make. I could like go out and find another big consulting client, go out and get a job, or I could stop working and make my own stuff. And I'd been kind of building little side projects on the side up until last November, and decided, okay, I'm gonna do this. And so I went to my wife and I said, "Hey, honey, what do you think about this idea of me not going and working anymore, but just working on a bunch of little things and maybe trying to make 100 projects in a year and then documenting it on this podcast called Mega Maker?" And she said no.
And I was like, so executive approval was denied.
Yeah, no approval there. And I was like, please, like I was just begging her. And so the deal we struck was, I said, if I can make a living, if I can keep paying our bills, keep food on the table, et cetera, let me do some exploration here. And the whole idea wasn't to like maybe go out and start a big startup. The whole idea is I'd been working ever since I was 22 up into 35, working full time for other people. And I just want, instead of kind of jumping feet first into starting a company or trying to build something really big, I just wanted to explore a bunch of different things. So my wife has called this kind of like my early midlife crisis, and it's actually probably a pretty good description. I just wanted to like try out a bunch of stuff and in some ways to learn, like learn new product skills, learn new marketing skills, and also just to kind of, you know, maybe figure myself out a little bit after working full time for all those years. let's try something else out. Let's learn a little bit about myself.
That's awesome. So how did you go from the answer of no to maybe let's see how things go for a little while?
Yeah.
Because it seems like there's a gap there that you might have glossed over some stuff. Did you trade one of your kidneys or something like that?
Well, it was just like, obviously it was a conversation. And I just said, honey, I think I can make this work. And one of the reasons I felt confident is I just released Marketing for Developers and it had done quite well. I think by that point, just doing some math off the top of my head, I mean, it probably done about $30,000 in sales or something like that. And so I felt like, okay, well, I've got this one product that seems to be selling pretty well. And I think that will give us some leeway to go and try some other things out. And my goal kind of revenue-wise was if I can bring in $10,000 a month just from doing whatever, I think we'll be okay. And so I've kind of each month it was like an experiment in, okay, how am I going to make money this month? And, you know, there was a few months where it was scary, like in May. May was the month where I decided I wanted to work on some software products. And so my buddy Marty and I had built a bulk SMS application called Network Effects. And then we said for the show, we wanted to launch two products at once and kind of examine the response to each of them. It's kind of like split testing product launch. And so we launched this other software product called Remote Workers, which was kind of an online community and what I call a reverse job board for remote workers. So we'd working on both of these, but because I was kind of heads down working on those, I hadn't been trying to make any money. And so I kind of lifted my head and was like, whoa, like I haven't made any money this month. What am I going to do? And I think I just toughed that one out because I knew that I was going to do a big sale in June. I did a deal with AppSumo. And so I was like, I think we'll be okay. So we just kind of toughed it out through May and then, you know, made it to June. Like to answer your question, every day my wife says, so when are you going to go get a job? And I'm like, I'm not getting a job. This is way too much fun. I'm going to keep going as long as I can.
I guess what I wanted to kind of drill into a little bit was whenever somebody is starting to kind of go down that entrepreneurial path, you know, as soon as the question or decisions start to come up around how are you going to make money and are you going to get a quote unquote real job that most people see that as a stable form of income, you know, and the merits of that statement are debatable at best. Mm-hmm. But most people look at that and say, we have to have a serious conversation about it. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what I want to drill into this.
Yeah.
Like, what was that conversation like? Because I think that a lot of people listening to this are on that path and you have to have your spouse on board in order to be an entrepreneur. There's really just no other way to do it, or you're divorced. I mean, it seems like those are the two paths that people would end up on.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing that made it easier is that we had kids quite young. We were married when we were 21 and we had our daughter Sadie when we turned 22. And before that, before 22, I had all through college, all through high school, I'd run my own little business. I had a video production and web design business in high school and college. And when we had our daughter, we made a decision that I would not do my own business and that I would work full time until all the kids were in school. And so this year, our youngest, we have four kids, and our youngest was in grade one full time. And so because that transition had happened, I said, hey, you know, you remember that conversation we had? Well, you know, now all the kids are in school and now I have this opportunity. Sprintly's just been sold and I could go do something else. Why don't I try to do that thing we talked about 15 years ago and let me try to do my own business again? And so that was part of the conversation. And the other conversation is, I said, you know, if this doesn't work out, I'll just go and look for a job or look for another client. But I said, you know, I think I could probably go out and find something else if I really needed to.
Yeah. And I think that that's something that can be comforting to the spouse is if you are in a position where you are in demand, they want you to come work for them. And if you ever needed to, you could fall back on that and you could go out and get a job in relatively short order. And I think that that's applicable to probably a lot of the people who are listening to this podcast, especially if you're in the tech world, just because there's so much demand for tech talent that if you are talented and you are publicly visible to a lot of people, mm-hmm. then it makes it easier for you to find full-time employment to fall back on if you really needed it.
Yeah, I mean, I think everything's a risk. I think employment kind of lulls you into sleep and in some ways and not recognizing how risky it is. Employment is just as risky as anything else, that you can get laid off at any time. And at least when you're running a business, you know your own financials, you kind of know what's coming down the pipe. But employment, you could just show up one day and be like, sorry, you're gone. And client work is even kind of worse in some ways. In some ways, you kind of know what's coming down the pipe, but other ways, just like, man, this could disappear at any moment. So I think there's kind of pros and cons to all of them.
Okay. Well, sorry for that little sidetrack there, but I thought it was important to drill into that initial conversation, because I think a lot of people are going to have that conversation early on where they're starting to build a product. But I wanted to have you on the call today so that we could talk about your Mega Maker project. Mm-hmm. And I guess, could you summarize, you know, very quickly exactly what the Mega Maker project is so that the listeners have an idea?
I had this idea that why don't I try to build 100 things? And some of these will be small little products. Some of these will just be creative things for me to explore on my own. And I'll document it on this podcast called Mega Maker. So it's kind of like a lab. It's like my marketing and product lab. I'm like working on all sorts of little things. So as an example, okay, we've got this little SMS app. What would it be like to run this as a full-time business? You know, and to really feel that. That's a big part of this whole experiment, is to like experience things without committing too much. Like just, okay, I'm going to try this out, try it on for size, see how it feels. Okay. That's interesting. And then kind of looking at everything. So for example, one thing I've learned over the past 6 months is that most of my revenue still comes from things like marketing for developers. People really go to me for product marketing advice, product marketing teaching, and you know, the lion's share of the money I've made so far has been there.
So it's kind of like this gives you the ability to launch kind of a mini product and get a feel for how much traction it gets without committing 3 months, 6 months, 9 months to a single thing, which may or may not pan out, or you may have to do a lot more validation.
Yeah.
I mean, if you keep these small enough, you can throw something out there, see how it goes. And it's not just that you can see how it goes, but you can see how well it does in relation to the other things that you're building, which gives you a much clearer picture of how well it could do.
Yes. But the other thing that I've been really thinking about, and it's almost more important to me right now, is we talk a lot about product market fit. I've been thinking a lot about market founder fit and product founder fit. For example, serving some markets, you don't really know what it's going to be like until you actually start doing it, right? And so, you know, there's some things I've launched where I'm like, okay, as an example, one idea I had was about 70, 80% of my audience is software developers. What if I like tried to bring some other types of creative people into the audience? So what if I reached out to artists and musicians and artisans and, you know, let's just see what that's like. What I discovered is I really like those people, but it's not really a market I want to serve. So there's not a fit there. There's no founder market fit there. Likewise, there's product founder fit. And I think this is a question a lot of people don't ask themselves, especially before they launch a SaaS business, is do you really want to run that kind of product? It's a lot different running SaaS than it is downloadable software, than it is info products. They're all very different. They all feel very different. And this has been an opportunity for me to try some of that stuff on. Like, okay, what would it be like to run this product every single day? What would it be like to serve this market every single day? And actually, the third one that I've been thinking about a lot lately, this idea of company founder fit. And what I mean by that is kind of like company structure. Rob Walling just had this quote I read about how to get above seven figures in SaaS revenue, you really need to have a team. And I've been thinking a lot about that too. Like up until now, I've been just working by myself or partnering up with people. What would it be like to, you know, have to hire a team, to pay salaries, to be a leader, to be a confidant for employees, to, you know, bear the weight of providing for all these different families?
Yeah, because you have to be responsible. Like if you hire somebody full time, you're essentially responsible not just for their job and their benefits and stuff like that. But in some cases, they're married and they have kids, you're responsible for their welfare as well. So it makes it, in my mind, it's much more challenging to run those types of scenarios. And I've done it before, and I've had to let people go where I knew that they had a wife and kids and they didn't have another job lined up. And it sucks. It's very difficult to be in that position. And I think it's something that you have to slowly work your way into. It's not something that you can just jump into and be able to just day one, know exactly what you're doing and feel confident about it. I mean, working your way up towards it is probably a better solution. I know that there's obviously the VC's funded startups and stuff don't have that luxury. They just kind of jump in head first. Mm-hmm. But as a bootstrapped company, I would hate to be in that position where you have to hire 10 people and then half of them don't work out or a quarter of them don't work
out. Yeah. And these are the things. I think a lot of product people are so desperate to build something that gets product market fit. And that's hard. Like finding something that a product that fits with a good market, a market that's able to pay you, a market that has demand for that thing that you've built. I mean, that alone is really hard. But there's these other vectors, which is like, does this even fit me as a person? A lot of us are kind of running away from something. We're like, we don't want to work for, you know, the man anymore. We don't want to work for clients anymore. And so we run towards product. But often we run towards product and we end up serving a customer base that we don't really like, or building a product that we're not really passionate about, or creating a company that we now have to run. We then become that boss that we really didn't like.
I wrote about that a little bit in my book because I met somebody who had a seven-figure business and he hated it. He didn't want any part of it, but he was so involved in it that there was no way for him to really get out of it. It was a services business, but at the same time, like, he was so involved on the relationship side of things that it would have been almost impossible for him to sell mm-hmm. it. So he kind of had no option. It was kind of like being locked into a job that you just didn't like. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And so this is all kind of the exploration I wanted to do with Megamaker. And so at the beginning, season one, it feels very much like watching a guy have a midlife crisis. Like, instead of going out and buying a Lamborghini, I'm like making things, you know? And the story that everyone talks about from that season is, I said, what would it be like to go to a restaurant and design a menu item for that restaurant and then like actually make it and then market it? Like, go through the whole product development process, not for software, but with something like food, because I'd never done that before. And so I convinced this restaurant to let me do a Friday lunch special. It's a barbecue restaurant. I said, okay, let's do, they didn't have a burrito on the menu, and I love burritos. So I said, let's try to make a Mega Maker burrito. There's kind of two goals with it. One was to just experience, okay, what is involved in making a food item at a restaurant? And two, how can I apply some of the things I've learned doing marketing and sales for software products to marketing this lunch special? And that story, I mean, I can't even remember the other episodes, but that story is still the one that people come up to me, you know, at a conference or whatever and say, man, like, that whole thing was insane. So that was just like me exploring stuff, just like figuring stuff out. And I know, like, you know, when you're running a tech event, like a conference or something, you need to like get people in the seats. Like, that's the most important thing. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to make a list of everyone who is going to come on Friday and order one of these burritos. So I had a spreadsheet where I was like calling people, emailing people, saying, okay, are you coming? How many burritos are you going to order? And so I had this running total because I wanted to make sure that we were above 60.
So you were essentially brute forcing your sales, like a lot of bootstrap software entrepreneurs. Yeah. Well, they'll brute force their way to like 20, 30, 50 customers in the early days. And you almost have to. Like, that's because you don't know what traffic channels are going to work for you. So you contact everybody you possibly know in order to get them
there. And so, and the whole time I was also like telling the story as it was happening. I was doing clips on Snapchat. I was doing little YouTube videos, just sharing the whole experience. And then the Friday came and it was like insane. We ended up selling 80 during the lunch hour. The restaurant was just like packed out the door. You can't get a seat. I was in the back actually making burritos. And so I got to experience everything. And it made me realize, one, I never want to do that again. But two, in terms of like product marketing, there's this great clip from that episode where this guy calls me over. I'm recording it. And he says, do you realize why people came here today? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, they like burritos. He's like, no, man, people are here because of the story. They wanted to come and be a part of the story. And that kind of marketing is completely applicable to the product world. I think a lot of times people get interested or engaged because of the story, and they're kind of following along, and they're like, that's how they become a customer. They were just following along with the story. So there were some parallels that were interesting.
Now, you mentioned marketing. Obviously, that was a one-time event. You got a bunch of people there, and yes, they're involved in the story, but how do you go about marketing for some of these other projects that you're launching? Because obviously, if you're doing 100 of them in a year, that averages out to roughly two per week. Mm-hmm. So one every 2.5 to 3 days, it doesn't really give you a heck of a lot of time to do marketing for mm-hmm. these. Do you do any follow-on marketing? Do you do advanced marketing for some of these different projects that you're launching? I know that not everyone is aimed at creating revenue or generating revenue for mm-hmm. you. But at the same time, there's got to be some base of people that you want to launch it out to or that you want to get it in front of, because there's really not much point of creating something if nobody's going to ever look at it or use it.
Yeah. I was having a conversation with Lars Lofgren. We were just talking about marketing. Him and I have known each other for a long time. And so we're just talking about marketing. And he said, one of the best things a marketer can do is realize that they're not going to be good at everything. You've really got to play to your strengths. And just hearing him say that, someone I really respect, it almost gave me permission to say, oh, that's great. Like, I can really like focus on these things that I'm really good at and still like, you know, still sharpen the axe as much as I can with things that I'm not super great at, but really double down on the things I'm good at.
Yeah. And I think that's important to know what your own limitations are, not just on the product side of things. Cause obviously if you don't know how to use a particular piece of technology, you can probably figure it out, but sometimes it's worth just paying somebody else to do it. But that also translates over onto the marketing side. Sometimes it's better to just pay someone else to do something that you really just don't like, which could be successful, but you don't want to do it cause you're just not good at it and you're not as comfortable with
it. Yeah. And that's why in the book, Marketing for Developers, I give so many different like channels and so many different techniques, because I just want people to be able to choose. When I was doing the customer research for that, a lot of folks would say, well, Justin, I'm just not good at writing blog posts. And so for people to be able to choose and kind of explore different things and then find the one that they're really good at, that's where you should kind of invest all your time and money, is in the thing that you're really good at, and then either hire out those other elements or just don't focus on them.
So I guess kind of going back to the heart of the question, though, like how much marketing are you actually doing for each of these individual projects?
It really depends. I mean, some of these are just things I need to get out of my system. So Network Effects, we launched on BetaList. We wanted to get a 10-person paid beta in both. So 10-person paid beta in Network Effects and 10-person paid beta in Remote Workers. And so, yeah, we launched on BetaList for that, got enough people in, and now we're just like basically getting their feedback. Like, okay, what are you using it for? What do you really like about it? Are you willing to keep paying? It's $9 for Network Effects. And then the plans are like similar to MailChimp or whatever.
Is that like an onboarding fee for that?
Yeah, it's basically because... Okay. With SMS, you have to pay for the number. Unless you get a custom number, it's not like very useful. And so we wanted to get people in, getting a custom number. And so mostly it's just to help pay for some of our costs. But it also is just a great way to figure out who's really serious about this. And yeah, like I said, over 10 people paid for that beta. And then the people that stuck around, I think there's like, of that group, there's about 3 that have stuck around. We're like really working with them and figure out, okay, what do you guys need? What are you using this for? You know, some of them are using it like every day or every week. And we're like, okay, we got to focus on these folks. Like, who are you? What are you doing this? How are you using this?
So like customer development.
Customer development. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, when we're ready to really kind of turn things on, in my mind, it's like you do a BetaList launch and then you get enough people to kind of try it out, really figure out who you're focusing on, and then launch to the waiting list. Again, kind of figure out, why are people signing up? That's the big question. Why are people signing up? And once you can figure that out, then after that, I do a product hunt launch. And then it's looking into other strategies like ads, SEO, etc.
So you keep saying we a lot, and maybe that just applies to this particular scenario, mm-hmm. but are you working on a lot of these by yourself, or do you have partners with some of them, teammates, people that are working with you either part-time or full-time on a regular basis, or is it just more one-off projects?
Yeah, it's me for almost all of them, except the bigger projects I've partnered up. And so my buddy Marty Dill, who's an awesome developer here in Vernon. And so when the idea for MegaMaker came around, I said, hey, Marty, you want to team up and, you know, build a few things? I'll find it for you. But I have this like agreement that I sign with people I want to team up with. And basically it says, we're going to work on this project for 6 months. And if we decide to turn it into a business, we both get like 50% ownership and then we move forward from there. If this doesn't turn into a business within 6 months, then we just let everything fold and we move on. I mean, it's been audited by a lawyer and everything else. It's just a way of like saying, okay, this is the purpose of right now. We're just testing out an idea. We're building the initial thing together. And then when it comes to turning this into a company, we'll both get equal shares.
It kind of forces the conversation up front, I guess, too.
Yeah, like I started signing these because I was doing even like small little partnerships. Like I built a WordPress plugin with Carl Alexander, and we're good friends. But we just wanted I'd seen enough like partnerships go real bad that I thought, you know, let's start signing something up front from day one. And it gives us such a great framework because it's like, if this doesn't work out in 6 months, we just move on. If this does work out and we want to turn this into a business, then we, you know, create the corporation. We both get 50% of the shares and then we treat it seriously. We treat it like a company. And there's a few other kind of conditions in there as well. But I found it a really great way to get started on projects, knowing that we're both kind of protected and we can both kind of trust each other for that period. And then, yeah, it kind of gives us a way of moving forward if we decide to, you know, take it from there.
So one of the other things that comes to mind is that while you're going through and launching a lot of these different projects, one thing that I've experienced this myself, but I've seen happen to other people, is that when you start on something, that's kind of the high point, you know, when you're kind of embarking on a new endeavor and everything's new and everything's exciting. But then 3 months, 6 months down the road, you start to get tired, you lose focus, you lose your motivation, I'll say, to continue. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that for a lot of these projects, that doesn't happen on an individual project basis because the timeline is for them is so short. But throughout the process of this, you're doing 100 of them in a year. Mm-hmm. Has that come into play for the project as a whole? Or does it, you really have low points for individual projects?
Oh, totally. Here's the stage I'm at right now. So if we look at the timeline, it starts off and I'm just exploring everything. Every idea that pops into my head, I put it on this list. You can see the list at megamaker.co/list. It's just a Google Doc. And anything that pops into my head, I'm like, I'm going to do that. I put it on the list. And it's exciting. I'm exploring all these things. I'm trying all these things. I'm starting. And starting's way easier than continuing, right?
Or finishing, yes.
Or finishing. And so that was the beginning. And some of these are bigger things that I really wanted to explore. Like, for example, going after a new market was interesting to me. You know, that's something I really wanted to explore. So even especially like physical makers, you know, for a long time, the term maker just applied to people that made like handmade furniture and art and sculpture. Lately, digital makers, people that make apps and software, have taken that term as well. But for a long time, it was just physical makers. And I thought, I wonder if they could be my audience too. And what I've realized is, do I really want to go out and like interview people that are making, you know, their own coffee tables or running their own Etsy shops? At the beginning, I thought that would be exciting to me, but now I'm realizing that no, that's not going to be exciting to me. And so the point I'm at right now is I'm like, okay, at the beginning, Mega Maker was about everything and my life was about like just exploring everything. Now we're 6 months in, it's time to start focusing. It's time to start closing down some projects, stopping some things and simplifying. And so I'm still planning on making 100 things through this year, but the show Mega Maker is going to be a lot more about products and marketing, software, digital products, similar things to what I've done before, because I'm realizing I went out and I explored a bunch of stuff, but I'm coming now back to one, the things I feel like I'm good at, two, the things that are making money. I guess those are the big things. Like, am I good at it? And is it making money? Do I really like the people I'm serving? Truthfully, you know, I was trying to bring these other kind of customers into my world. But truthfully, like most of the people that kind of listen to Mega Maker are my same audience, mostly software developers, designers, product people, entrepreneurs. And so I'm going to start doubling down on those. Yeah, stopping some of these projects that didn't feel like a good fit.
So did you find it difficult to complete some of those projects, or was it more of a after the fact that you decided, hey, you know, this isn't something that I really should go after because of the results of it? Was it more because of how you felt early on in going after it? Because I think with a list that you've got going, you can look through that and kind of pick and choose what it is that you work on. Mm-hmm. So chances are good you'll probably be excited about it at the time. But it sounds to me like throughout the process of this, you're also kind of dialing things back and you're trying to figure out what it is that you want to work on moving forward as well.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bunch of things. One thing I realized is at the beginning, I was just like a kid in a candy shop, and I had freedom for the first time in my life. You know, I wasn't working full time. I'd always had side projects, but now I could like give all my time to these things. And I just started way too many things at once. So I've gone back to just like working on one thing at a time. Right now, I'm working on a new book called Jolt. And it's 20 surprising marketing tactics, like things that most people don't talk about. It's going to be really good. It's going to be exactly for that group of people that I've already connected with. So right now I'm trying to not focus on other things and just like work on Jolt, like every day, try to get some writing in every day, try to finish another chapter. And I'm hoping to launch it July 15th. And when that's done, you know, I'll focus on the next thing. So one thing at a time. And yeah, there were some things I just didn't want to finish. And I think that's okay, you know, especially if you start a software project and you're like, man, this is not a good fit for me. Carl and I just had this conversation because we've been maintaining this plugin and it's still selling pretty good. But I noticed like he was always the one to answer customer support emails first. And I just was never getting to them. And part of it was I just wasn't excited about it anymore. It just wasn't a good fit for me. And so I just said, you know what, Carl, you just take this 100%. Like, I'm okay with removing this from my plate.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of, I guess, that goes into the feelings of procrastination for something around the fact that you just simply don't want to do it and you're not interested in it. It's not because you haven't prioritized mm-hmm. it. So it doesn't mean as much to you, or you know, are dreading doing it. I think you said much earlier in the episode something about how a lot of times entrepreneurs are running away from something, and that brought you to the idea that make sure that what you're running towards is also something that you want. It's not something else that you're going to want to run away
from. Yeah, exactly. And because of that, we have to be willing to quit some projects. We have to be willing to either let them die or give them away or sell them or something. And I think that's the piece that most of us struggle with.
Yeah, walking away from that stuff is hard.
Yeah, walking away from it. Like, for example, this next phase of Mega Maker, I have an online community for Mega Maker. And I know that this next phase is going to tick some people off. Like, some people are going to be like, what? This isn't about the thing you said it was going to be about in the beginning. And I'm like, well, I have to change this. I have to, you know, keep kind of narrowing this down to something that's going to work. And so having to upset people is really hard. Like say, I'm sorry, but I'm going to be changing the product, or I'm going to be changing the focus, or we're going to move this way.
Well, I think that's also one of the traps that like people fall into when they are launching a product, because if you never actually launch it, then you never have to worry about disappointing people.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing I've learned is you get really good at launching and getting over those fears the more you launch. And so part of my message from the beginning, both with Build and Launch, and now this is kind of like version 2.0 of what I was doing with Build and Launch. The message from the beginning is start small and start now. Like, if you've never launched anything, don't go out and try to launch the next HubSpot. Like, launch something super, super tiny and then get that done, like get it done in a week, and then launch a 2-week project, and then launch a 3-week project. And the more you do that, the better you get at getting over that sense of dread, that sense of fear, and you just learn so much each time. And so the dread that I used to have from like launching things, I still get nervous. Like before this Jolt launches, I'm going to be feeling the exact same thing everyone else is, like, ah, is anyone going to buy this? Did I do the right things? Am I targeting this the right way? But I don't feel the same kind of like anxiety as I used to. It's a lot easier the more that you do it.
That's very much, I guess it aligns very well with what Rob Wallen came up with, which was the stair-step approach, which you can kind of apply to this, where his was more about the types of products that you're building. Mm-hmm. But this is also about becoming more comfortable over time with doing the same thing, launching things over and over
again. Yeah, I think the one thing that I really want to kind of impress on people is that there's no one path to success. And I think a lot of folks are like trying to follow other people's path to success. And one of the things I wanted to explore was this idea of, you know what, I'm going to go and just try a bunch of different things and figure out what's the right fit for me. And I think anybody can do that. You don't have to pick 100 things. You don't have to, but be willing to kind of like try things out, look at your strengths and evaluate whether it's really a good fit for where you want to be, and especially make sure that you're not running into the same thing that you're running away from.
Yeah, and I think that that's probably a really fantastic note to leave off on. So, Justin, tell the listeners where they can find you, and if they want to follow on the Mega Maker story, or if they just want to sign up for your email list or follow you on Twitter, et cetera, where can they find you?
I write at justinjackson.ca. On Twitter and Snapchat, I'm the letter M, the letter I, Justin. That's M-I, Justin. And Mega Maker is megamaker.co.
And we'll link all those up in the show notes for everybody. Well, Justin, I just wanted to say thank you very much for coming on. I hope that this was educational for the listeners. And I really do appreciate you kind of driving home that point at the end there about finding what is right for you versus what everybody else is doing. I think that's a very, very powerful piece.
Beauty, Mike. Yeah, it's been a pleasure, man.
I think that about wraps us up for the day. If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupstherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupstherestofus.com for full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.